invited guests who are here to make presentations. You are all welcome. The purpose of today's meeting is to hear submissions on the Criminal Law Sexual and Related Matters Amendment Bill that has come back to us, because there are certain defects that we have been directed by the court to deal with. So we have had to request Parliament to apply to the Judge President for permission to extend the deadline, because as you know, we are not only a representative democracy, but we are a participatory democracy. And for us, whatever laws we pass, legislative processes we embark on, it is important that the public and all stakeholders be given sufficient time to make their inputs. We are pleased as well to say that we received about 403 submissions. And when we extended the deadline, we received 404 submissions, and when we extended the deadline, we got more than 900. We received 932 submissions. That shows the extent to which the public and other stakeholders are interested in this process. So we are happy that our people take the parliamentary processes important. They want to own these processes. They want to make input into these processes to ensure that the legislation that we come out with is representative of the will of the people and has the support of the people. Now, because we have deadlines of Parliament to meet, I want to request that we first adopt the report of the committee, which has been distributed, to give the Parliament an opportunity to start processing the request to the Chief Justice, and then we can commence with our hearings. But I will allow Mr. Swartz to input or anyone of you who wants to comment on what has been said.
Now, thank you, Chair. You'll remember that I did recommend this suggestion. I think we just need to change it one or two wording at the very last paragraph, where it says, in the light of the above, the committee recommends that the National Assembly condones its request. I think we need to find another word, probably supports. We're not asking the National Assembly to condone our act. We're asking the court to condone. So I would just suggest supports there, and I'm not sure whether one wants to add in a sentence about the deadline being extended. That's not really that urgent, as extended by 1 week. But subject to that, Chair, I would move for this support of the adoption of this report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Members, in your packs, the number of the submission they're making is marked B18/2014 No. 897. B18/2014-897. I hope you'll find it. Can I proceed and ask Mr. Omar to address it?
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Mr. Matole Motsepe, Honorable Members of Parliament, respected colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, all protocols observed. Just to begin the history of the Teddy Bear Clinic, as you are aware, it's a non-profit organization. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Perfect. The Teddy Bear Clinic works with both victims of child abuse and child sex offenders. We've been in the business for 28 years, and our medical legal clinic work is based at the Johannesburg General Hospital and falls under the Department of Pediatrics of the Medical School of the University of the Witwatersrand. This clinic was established in response to an urgent need for medical examinations for children. We provide a comprehensive service for child victims of abuse and child victimizers, from forensic assessments, psychological assessments, counseling, and all forms of therapeutic support. We also provide educator training on sexual abuse, diversion programs for young sex offenders, and training and research, and we do a lot of sexual awareness programs at schools. So why did the Teddy Bear Clinic decide to take this matter to court? Section 15 and 16 of the Sexual Offences Act made it a crime for children between the ages of 12 and 15 to engage in any and all conduct of a consensual sexual nature, which included holding hands, cuddling, kissing, and other behaviors part of a normal adolescent sexual development. Judge Rabin ruled in favor of the applicant, stating that the provisions in the Sexual Offences Act, open quote, criminalize significant numbers of children for engaging in consensual sexual activities, close quote. These consensual sexual activities are of a wide range of acts that would commonly be performed by children engaging in ordinary sexual exploration. We at the Teddy Bear Clinic firmly believe and support the amendment bill that it should not be criminalized. Criminalization is both labeling and disempowering, and it induces secondary trauma on the child. Hence, it is in contravention of the best interests of the child. Apart from creating strange anomalies when read with other laws relating to children, these sections infringe a range of children's constitutional rights, including equality, and were not rationally connected to the purpose the state claims is sought to achieve with these sections, that is to protect children and persons with disabilities from being abused by adults. Even when children were diverted away, they did not avoid the substantial trauma or harm created by the exposure to earlier processes in the criminal justice system, such as arrest, questioning by police officials, and detention themselves. The questioning had negative effects on the dignity of children, and arrest and detention obviously exacerbated the negative effects. The Teddy Bear experience in dealing with adolescents engaging in consensual sex were: we know that it is a known fact that public exposure and humiliation is a real risk, as was the case with the Jules High School in Gauteng. The wider school community suffered from this public exposure, and the children were even ashamed to leave their school premises in their school uniform because of the negative labeling and social stigma that emerged and added to the victimization of the children, who were both directly and indirectly implicated. The children that were implicated in this consensual sexual activity were forced to attend a diversion program. They had to appear in court and experience the rigorous and brutal procedures in court. Yes, although diversion has not had a lot of merit, in this instance it was not appropriate. The one young girl from the Jules High matter was in therapy for a long time, wrecked with guilt, shame, self-blame and stigma. In addition, she manifested compelling symptoms of depression, self-mutilation, suicidal thoughts and ideation because of the stigma. She felt labeled and questioned her behavior, which had a devastating impact on her well-being. She failed to complete her schooling and dropped out because she was not coping emotionally. These provisions were particularly harmful for girl children, as girls can bear a physical marker of sexual intercourse in the form of pregnancy where boys do not. Girls would thus be easy targets for prosecution under these misguided laws. Far from deterring risking behavior, this also discouraged girls from reporting rape for fear of being charged with so-called consensual sexual penetration or violation. This not only puts them at risk, but also lends itself to girls experiencing deep psychological scarring from the discrimination they would experience from the state and quite possibly from the communities in which they live, as was found in the Jules High saga. The two young girls who were implicated in this incident did not return to the school and had moved to other schools. The media coverage and reach out by senior government officials made the one girl's identity more visible. We will now reflect on the vengeful father syndrome. The Teddy Bear Clinic also received referrals from fathers who made allegations that their daughters had been raped when in actual fact it was consensual. A typical example was that of a 15-year-old girl who was in a consensual sexual relationship with a 15-year-old boy from her school. When this was accidentally discovered by the father, he laid a charge of rape against the boys. They were both sent for diversion to the Teddy Bear Clinic. The young girl, through the process of counseling, made a disclosure that it was consensual sex. And through the diversion process, she started presenting signs of secondary trauma as it became public knowledge within the school community about what had happened to her. Other similar incidents of false allegations have also been made by other parents. This has resulted in an intrusion of control into the intimate and private sphere of children's personal relationships in a manner that would cause severe harm to them, inducing secondary victimization. Instead of being helpful, it was more harmful and hence counterproductive. Presenting with an increased incidence of teenage pregnancies, because if these children or young girls went to healthcare facilities to access contraception, they would be reported and hence be subjected to the criminal justice system. The incidence of backstreet abortions also increased as the girls were too afraid to seek TOP, the termination of pregnancies, through the state, as this would result in them being reported to the authorities. As it is a legal obligation to report according to Section 54 of the Sexual Offences Act. These backstreet abortions also presented with other challenges, that is, incomplete abortions and infections. It needs to be reiterated and emphasized that at no stage was and is sex between teenagers condoned or encouraged. We are a child abuse clinic and focus on the well-being of each child and every child. No request has ever been made to lower the age of consent. The age of consent has remained the same, which is 16 years. We will now focus on false allegations of rape in the case of pregnancy. Young girls were also seeking help at the Teddy Bear Clinic alleging that they were raped by strangers because of their pregnancy status and were too afraid to admit that they were in fact in a consensual sexual relationship because of the legal implications it would have on both parties. Criminalization of consensual sexual acts, especially coupled with the duty to report, limits the ability of both parents and support organizations to educate, empower, guide, and support adolescents in their sexual development. This they cannot do because they cannot be seen to promote behavior that is illegal. Parents were obliged to report any form of intimate contact to the police or relevant authorities. Whereas, what is required is an open and frank discussion between children and adults about positive sexual behavior. We would like to highlight that these cases do not affect or deal with any acts of sexual violence perpetrated by children. It deals exclusively with consensual sexual acts between children. Any non-consensual violent sexual offenses committed by children will still be dealt with in the criminal justice system in line with the Child Justice Act. There are glaring contradictions which stipulate that adolescents do not have the capacity to make choices about their sexuality. Yet, on the other hand, they could be held criminally liable for such a choice. The Teddy Bear Clinic supports the proposed amendments to Section 15 and 16, which was an outcome of the Constitutional Court ruling. We would like to propose the following. Professionals and parents should provide children with the necessary support and guidance about sexuality to make informed decisions without fear of incriminating the child or themselves. Two, what is required is an open and frank discussion between children and adults about positive sexual behavior. Three, government departments should invest in parenting programs to facilitate open dialogue between parents and children. Schools should be equipped and empowered to provide adequate education and information through their life skills program. Theoretically, schools are supposed to be providing it, but on the ground, there are some limitations there. Finally, there should be a shift from punishment to prevention. We would like to draw your attention to sections 46, 47, and 48. The Teddy Bear Clinic supports the proposed amendments to these sections that deal with the responsibility of convicted sex offenders to disclose that they are on the register. We support the both provisions with amendments. They are as follows. Firstly, children convicted of a sexual offense should not automatically go on the register, as this is problematic because children are treated in the same way as adults. It should not be a one-size-fits-all. Children should not automatically be placed on the register unless the child presents a high risk of re-offending or has committed more than one offense. It has to be compelling circumstances which must be at the discretion of the court what those circumstances are. It should be the responsibility of the state that there is individualized assessment. Secondly, it also places a burden on the child to make representation to the court to motivate why his or her name should not be placed on the register. Thirdly, this could also have further implication of costs because children who cannot afford legal representation may not be in a position to make the submission. The cost of the representation should be at the cost of the state to ensure that all children have equal access. Finally, and lastly, the issue of assessment is critical, and there is no clarity around this issue. Who will bear the costs? Who will conduct these assessments? It should also be clarified who the suitably qualified persons are to conduct the assessments, such as social workers and psychologists. In conclusion, I would like to say, just quote a learned scholar, Nwabdam, that children are born, but people are made. And in Zulu, in a Zulu proverb, umuntu umuntu ingabantu, a person is a person through other people. Thank you.
Providing empirical evidence of what you are presenting to us. Before I open up, I just want to say that you place more emphasis on professional and parents, government departments, and schools. You know, we have a youthful society. We have children giving birth to children. So when you talk about parents, you're also referring to other children. So I hope that you have a look at that. But also, you know, I think that we need to look at what is already there inside society. If you look at the traditional community, you have queen mothers. They are actually doing this work of educating the children. Maybe what we need, the support that we are talking about, is that government should support the community structures so that we have community participation in this whole matter. But I think your presentation is very, very well structured, reasoned, backed up by the intelligence. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Honourable members,
honourable
shots, honourable women.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. This is an issue which we've struggled with for many years. You remember I was part of the initial drafting of the bill. Obviously, from our perspective, we would hold the moral viewpoint that it is wrong for adolescents to engage in sex, and I don't think anyone is promoting that. What we're sitting with is a judgment that we as Parliament have to adhere to, and to what degree we can adjust our bill and adjust the legislation. And clearly there was a need to improve the legislation, so our thanks to the Teddy Bear Clinic for bringing it to court so that we can get clarity on some of the issues relating to the register, to the broad definition, hugs and kissing, section 16. But just on that aspect, when you mention hugs and kissing, we know the maxim as well, de minibus non curat lex. And it is regretful that that bill became known as the kissing bill, because it was a very progressive bill. And I'd like your comments on that, because there was no intention and there would be no prosecution of anyone kissing and hugging each other. That is a definition that is contained in many foreign jurisdictions as well. What we're looking at centrally is the issues relating to full penetrative sex. That's what we're looking at. Of a homosexual and a heterosexual nature dealing with children, ages of 12 to 16. And what the role of the state should be, what the role of the family should be, what the role of faith-based organizations should be. And the court has given us parameters now. I might not necessarily agree with that, but we abide by that. Now, that having been said, what would you say would be the role of the state, given that if the court found, firstly, that, let me just read you paragraph 81, except for the purposes of discouraging adolescents, we all agree we're not promoting sexuality, from prematurely engaging in consensual sexual conduct, which may harm their development, and from engaging in sexual conduct in a manner that increases the likelihood of risks associated with sexual conduct materializing are legitimate and important. So the court recognized that the state has got a role to play. And the court said criminalization is not the answer. Now we would, from our side, we're looking at some mechanism to protect those vulnerable young adolescents from penetrative sex, which obviously carries a lot of risks. The court accepted that there are risks in that regard. That's the first issue. Secondly, we know we're not dealing with the age of consent. We're dealing with a narrow issue. But most of the submissions that have been made have made the point that, in effect, practically, and I'd like you to comment on that, the age of consent has been reduced by the decriminalization from 16 to 12. Would you see decriminalization to mean that or not? And if so, why do you have the age of 18 when it comes to gambling, when it comes to buying cigarettes, when it comes to driving, and we're now looking at that age group? Obviously, it depends on the cognitive development of the child that is a concern of ours. How do we protect vulnerable young children? No one wants to send a child to jail for engaging in such experimentation. But how do we protect them? What is the best interest of the child? It's quite a mouthful, but that's the ambit of the debate we're going to be engaging in. Thank you.
I want to agree with you that is the ambit of the debate, and therefore we shouldn't expect it to address the whole debate and let her respond but to the best of your ability, but don't feel obliged to deal with matters that are not within your competence.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. In response to children, I think just looking at the Children's Act, the Children's Act addresses children that are at risk, vulnerable children, so for me, I believe that there is provision made for that category of children who will be a risk to themselves and a risk to society. So they would, would receive the intervention, statutory services, whatever is required, and would enter specific programs. And in terms of you mentioned about decriminalization, again, you said for the special category of children who are, if I understood you correctly, the cognitively impaired, or if the child is not functioning at the age of consent, of course, again, there's provision made for that. So, we have in terms of services, I mentioned to you that there are psychological assessments. Both the Children's Act utilizes that, and in the NGO sector, children are assessed regularly, if they are presenting challenging behavior or risky behavior, a child is first assessed. So individualized assessments are provided within the NGO sector, the child protection sector. But also in terms of responsibilities, I think the Honorable Chair highlighted a very important fact, that our intervention is based on an ecological framework. So starting with the family, the origin where the child actually comes from, family, neighborhood, environment, peers, very important. I think the Honorable Chair highlighted that education and all government departments. So it's not just an isolated effort of intervention, but it's something that needs to be worked together in order to ensure the best interest of children and to protect children from any form of scourge, violence, and trauma.
Are you happy with that?
Again, I think I mentioned in my presentation the anomalies, because if we look at the different pieces of legislation, we know that government departments have been working in silos. If we look at the age of consent for termination of pregnancy, it's theoretically 12 years, but we know that a child of any age, because we are a medical legal clinic, a child of any age qualifies for a termination of pregnancy without the consent of the parent. However, should the child require, if anything goes wrong with that termination of pregnancy, and should the child now require further surgical intervention or procedures, then they require the consent of the parent, because the age of consent for surgical procedures is 18 years. So what I'm saying is that there are contradictions in the pieces of legislation. If we look at the age of consent for HIV testing, age of consent for not only as I mentioned HIV, POP, and contraceptives, accessing contraceptives. Again, these are challenges because the one doesn't speak to the other. And our Honourable Minister Aaron Motsoaledi last year propagated the distribution of condoms, yet the age of consent, it's contradicting. There's glaring discrepancies. So I think I just wanted to highlight that for you. Thank you, Honourable.
Thank you. I saw your head nearly fell off. What was wrong?
I think this act, people at home are always saying, how can you allow a child to have to consent to termination of pregnancy without my consent? So it is always then. But anyway, the question I wanted to find out from you was, you seem to be worried about a child who is well consented to sex in criminalized. And do I get it correct?
Well, I think it's important to understand we are concerned about children who have to undergo the brutal procedures and suffer trauma, that it induces secondary victimization, that it's harmful to their well-being, to their emotional and psychological well-being, because we have found that these children come in more troubled and are disturbed, and as a result manifest symptoms of, as I highlighted in one of the cases, we've had post-traumatic stress disorder, they're not able to function after going through this process. They suffer more as a result of actually entering the criminal justice system. The criminal justice system, instead of helping the child, has actually created more damage to the child. And this is not just one child, it's a lot of children that have entered the process and have suffered undue mental stress, where they've suffered from not being able to sleep, not performing at school, becoming immobilized, and as a result, the secondary trauma, immobilizing them and disempowering them.
I wanted to find out whether you make a distinction between a child who has consented to sex and the one who did not consent.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yes.
Now, if that is the case, I have you. Are you aware of the difficulty that can be for the prosecutor having to prove that there was in fact consent? I mean, they will all go to court, because the other one, in your example, the father said, my child was raped. So you have to go to court. In court, the law was saying no consent. You are saying that if there is consent, which means the prosecutor must now prove that there was consent. And then the prosecution will probably end that, according to your theory. How do you go around that? Secondly, there could also be pressure on the girl child who did not consent, in fact, say your consent, then my client would be off the hook, you know, and otherwise there would be pressure, because these are neighbors, and so on. That is the second question. The third one is,
court must consider compelling circumstances before the name can be put into the register for a child. I think it's a good thing. But can you give examples of the compelling circumstances in this?
I don't want to interfere with your line of questions, but I think we're beginning also to deal with burdens of proof in court, rules of which Ms. Roma may not be aware of. But I can see that their concern is to address the best interest of the children from the standpoint of their professional responsibility. So I will allow you to respond, but again, I'm going to be forced to say things that are not within your competence.
Okay, thank you for that, Honorable Chair. I think just to emphasize that there are procedures, assessment procedures, to establish the veracity and credibility of all children, whether they be victims or victimizers. And we, besides the forensic medical examinations, there are forensic assessments that are conducted to ascertain the reliability of the victim or the victimizer. So those assessments are conducted and presented to the court, and then as our Honorable Chair has highlighted that the burden of proof rests on the court. The trier of fact has to make that call or decision. But we also, in terms of our more holistic approach to intervention, we also provide therapeutic psychosocial support to both victim and victimizer, because often victimizers are victims as well.
No, thank you, Chair. I would like to thank the Chief Chair for raising this matter, the manner of hearing, and further at the report. It's quite very clear, Chair. But my problem to this will be the extent to which the access legislature with the policy proposals on how we take these matters forward, because it is quite very clear here how to go about, but they just drop the ball somewhere. We've got to take it further to say how do we assist the legislature to take these matters forward, including the matter of synchronizing the age group between 12 and 16 and 18. So they assist us to make clear proposals for purposes of legislating these things. Otherwise, I understand what the court comes from. I understand also the issue before us, because in the main, my understanding is that it's not that we are promoting that children must enter into the sexual intercourse. But what we're saying is that it should not be a crime where they've just consented amongst themselves. So generally, I think the intention is very good from the court side. I think I welcome the presentation, Chair. Yes.
Thank you, thank you very much. I think it is quite clear that society itself must do its work. Government departments must do their work and stop working in silence. I think if we can all be alive to all these responsibilities, backed by your professional expertise, we can move things forward. Thank you very much. I know that some may be wanting to say more, but unfortunately time is not on our side. But you have got the gist of the proposal, and as the MP is
government, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for giving us the opportunity as the RATCAM resources aimed at the prevention of child abuse and neglect, the second applicant in the Constitutional Court case, to make a presentation. And I think my story starts where Dr. Omar's story ends. The responsibilities in our society of parents, of adult caregivers where no biological parents exist, of faith-based organizations, of community organizations, of the state departments and of legislatures. So, I mean, in the course of my life, and I'm sure you've had the same, I have had the opportunity, especially in this matter, to come across very inspirational people that give me practical examples of the kind of society that I want to live in, the kind of society that I want my children to grow up in. During the course of consultations in relation to this law, we came across a mother, quite a middle-aged mother, single mother, who told us that she felt it very important, her job to raise the children was very important to her, and her duty to inform the children and best empower them to make decisions that influence their lives was very important to her. And she felt that critical to this growth path was her children's sexuality. And so because she didn't perhaps have a model of a parent who spoke to her about sexuality, she identified in her community a nurse who she would invite to dinner time conversations with herself and her children to mutually inform across generations the value system that should underpin life choices for adolescents. Another example for me is a married father who talks about the most important part of sexuality with his boys daily. The most important part of sexuality is love and care. And he models this with their mother. So this is the society that I want to live in. A society where adults and the adult duty bearers for children's rights take their place. I am the custodian for that organization. I'm the executive director of RATCAM for the past 6 years. The organization has fought for children's rights realization for the past 25 years. And one particular project which we were instrumental in initiating, the Child Witness Project, is exactly the reason why the Sexual Offences Act exists. It is a project that gives support to children who have been sexually abused by adults. Mainly girl children, sexually abused by mainly men. So this is the reason why the Sexual Offences Act exists. This is the reason why the age of consent exists in the Act. The age of consent exists in order for us to know when adults should not be interfering with children, to protect adults from malicious, to protect children from malicious adults. This is the age of consent. So, and I understand that we want to protect our child from this reality, but the Constitutional Court gave us a eye-opener, I believe, to say that in some cases, adults, well-meaning adults, can go too far in the way that they want to protect children, and they can actually inflict harm on children. So the Constitutional Court maybe encouraged us to use adult power and not want to control adolescent behavior by leading to do more harm than good. So RATCAM is the second applicant in the case, and we challenge the sections of the law that criminalize consensual sexual conduct between adolescents because we believe that there is also the potential to devastate family life. The law also separated children from the adult caregivers in their lives, because if the adult caregivers in their lives understood that they were experimenting sexually, the adult caregivers would have to report them. That is the effect of the law as it currently stands. We do not support that law. So the Constitutional Court judgment pronounced that children's rights to dignity was infringed upon by the criminalization of children. Because the criminal justice system, as Dr. Omar has told you, is not a pleasant place. Even if you're a victim of a crime, it is not a pleasant place to be. We need to develop productive intergenerational relationships, not based entirely on adult control. And also, we must be alive to the realities of our society. We cannot humiliate and withhold sexuality information from adolescents, which is harmful to their positive growth and development. I take you back to those two stories. We have to recognize that sexuality is part of our life. And we can't just jump from sexuality equals sex. There is much more to sexuality than just the act of sex. We are privileged in this country to have prolific researchers, two of which supported our Constitutional Court application in evidence. And I think it's been made mention that only their evidence has been contributed to the case. But in fact, they reviewed over 40 empirical works to construct their evidence in this case. There are researchers which I have read up on, Fisher, Kieber, Jukes, Matthews, Barna, Petman. All of them have done work on adolescent sexuality in contemporary South Africa. There are works that date in the 2012-2014. I'm going to read you an extract of a work that Kieber, Jukes, Matthews, Fisher made in 2012. And it substantiates my point that adolescents need information from non-judgmental and caring adults to inform their life choices. They spoke with adolescents openly about sexuality, tried to understand what their sexuality questions and concerns were and how best to support this. And they found adolescents appreciated openly discussing intimate relationships, sex and peer culture within a non-judgmental and non-punitive interaction because it gave them the opportunity to reflect on their beliefs, choices, behavior, and they felt that it would be useful for their peers to have the same experience. So we have, as RAPCAN, also engaged in model building of sexual decision-making programming within schools. And through that programming, I myself was a facilitator in a high school of that program. In that programming, you can see that adolescent children are hungry for the ability to talk with trusted adults who will guide and support them. I remember also, completely off the point, but the relationships that you establish once you open a communication channel can also have other positive consequences. One of the boys in my class with the sexuality training came to me and said to me, he wanted the number for a drug rehab center. And he gave me the number of his mother. And I phoned his mother, and his mother was also wanting to help him in this healing place, in this healing path. You see the important role we can have as adults when we open communication channels and we don't shut children down, try to control them, try to humiliate them, and try to disempower them by withholding information. Adolescents should be empowered by adults to make independent decisions about sexuality and life choices. The Constitutional Court ruling by Judge Sachs, an eminent judge in our society, in 2007, recognize the autonomy of children. And he said, individually and collectively, all children have the right to express themselves as independent social beings, to have their own laughter as well as sorrow, to play, imagine and explore in their own way, to themselves get to understand their bodies, minds and emotions, and above all to learn as they grow how they should conduct themselves and make choices in the wide social and moral world of adulthood. I think it's on that basis that Judge Hamtepe, in the Constitutional Court case that we were involved in, had the ability to recognize that adolescent sexuality when we prohibit consensual intimate relations, intrudes on the core of adolescents' privacy. So she was reminding us that we should also see children as people, adolescents as people. If we say we live in a rights oriented society, those rights extend to everyone. So I want to see a society fit for children. If criminalization is and control is not an option for this committee, if that is not an option, what is the option, honorable members have asked? I would suggest maybe guidance is the option. Guidance and support of adolescents. And that guidance and support of adolescents may not come through your committee, but it may come through collaboration with other committees around social development, education, and health. It may go to support the currently currently approved National Adolescent Sexual and Reproductive Health Rights Framework Strategy, which Cabinet has passed in February 2015, which says that we need to attend to adolescent sexual health and rights. That's why I submit to you, honorable members of Parliament in this committee, your role is to help us guide and support children and to help the primary caregivers and adult duty bearers within children's lives to be able to guide their value system and their morality. I thank you.
So, Mrs. Nondo. Yeah, again, you can see everything comes back to society. Are we trying to replace the responsibilities of parents, society, with the law? Because if we do so, the law needs to be enforced. And then the law requires prosecution results incarceration. Incarceration also bring about other complications. So as we discuss, let's not forget that these children are our children, they live with us, we take them to school, we are their teachers, and let's not get the law to do things that we should do ourselves. Honorable members, Honorable Swart.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I appreciate your passion and for adolescent rights, but how do we protect children from themselves, where they might not have the cognitive development as a 12-year-old to understand the long-term implications of engaging in full penetrative sex? We appreciate that decriminalization has now been found to be unconstitutional, and we need to be very careful what message is sent out as a result of that judgment, that it is not now fine for everyone to engage in adolescent sex. I think we're all in agreement about that. But firstly, children must be protected from themselves, and secondly, from other predatory children under the age of 16. Now, the point that was made by my colleague, at the moment in that age group, due to criminalization, a child cannot consent. Should there be an abuse situation where the adolescent 15-year-old raped a young 12-year-old, the rape kicks in, but the young child at the moment cannot give consent. And inevitably, in cases which I'm sure you've dealt with, the perpetrator says the young, vulnerable person gave consent. And that's the issue that he was trying to raise about disproving consent in a court. So that is an avenue that then falls away from a protection perspective. But when you weigh the baskets, I fully appreciate what you're saying, with adolescents not seeking assistance because of the possibility of criminal constraints. So one's got to balance these baskets at the end of the day. You might be giving up that protection that children have with a child cannot consent, therefore does not have to prove consent. You understand what I'm trying to say? The prosecutor has to prove that the young victim did not consent to the act. At the moment she can't consent. And I think that's a very clear thing. That's why only 10% of cases of rape are or vulnerable people do not want to go through the secondary trauma of giving evidence and have to disprove consent having been given. That's the one point. So what we're looking for then, having decriminalization being set aside, but we know we're living, and clearly families need to take steps up to the front, society, but we live in a dysfunctional society. We've got 1.5 million orphans. Rural society, how are we going to protect the rural children from other children where a young 12-year-old might not have the cognitive development? Now, I notice in your submission on page 3, you say decriminalizing adolescents aged 12 to 16-year-olds consenting to sex with their peer group who are not below the age of consent. They cannot consent to sex with anyone more than 2 years older or younger. Would you support a 2-year closing age for the age group 12 to 16? From reading that, that's what you seem to be saying. And that might be some way of protecting children from themselves. But whether that is in line with the Constitutional Court is another question. So there are a number of issues that I feel you also referred to the expert evidence, and correctly, I previously said it was only the expert of Fisher and Giver. I wasn't part of the court case. My understanding was, when I read the judgment, was the judgment relied almost solely on the evidence of the two of them and obviously their whole expert evidence. But what is very important is just to bear in mind that there are many people in South Africa that would disagree with the view that they say, when they speak about developmentally normative, that it is not unusual or necessarily unhealthy and harmful for adolescents to engage in sexual behaviors. Not clearly you can again teaching, but what concerns us is full penetrative sex, homosexual, heterosexual nature. And I'm sure many people would differ when it says it is not necessarily unhealthy or harmful to engage in that conduct, when you bear in mind high rates of teenage sex, teenage pregnancy, HIV/AIDS, psychological and emotional trauma. So the question is, how do you balance those two interests? And that's the issue that we are wrestling with. Thank you.
So, you are saying that society is dysfunctional. And now, are you suggesting that because society is dysfunctional, its responsibilities must be taken to the criminal justice system, which itself is overburdened?
May I just clarify? Let me say there are many dysfunctional families. There are many aspects of society that is dysfunctional in South Africa. I'm not saying everyone, maybe I must correct that, but the state has got a legitimate interest to play a role in assisting, whether it is from social development, maybe it's not in the criminal justice sector, but there is a legitimate, that's why we are social workers. And that is all I'm trying to say, is that there is a legitimate need. The state can't just take its hands off and say, this is fine. It must continue. We know there is a dysfunctionality. That's why we have such a high level of sexual offences in our society.
Mandela foresaw this case when he launched the Moral Generation Movement, so that society must take responsibility for addressing these issues, so that we don't try to use the law or criminal justice system against children, because we fail to do our work as society. And I think our two presenters are really helping us on this issue, but it's not for me to judge. Let me open the discussion to the honorable members. Honorable Bonga?
No, thanks, Chair. I don't think we need to be quite emotional about the subject for today. I don't think we need to be emotional about the subject before us today. The only realization that comes to me now is that we need a lot of stakeholders to deal with the matter that we're dealing with. So just to take one sector and think it will solve this problem, it will create problems for all of us again. Because as it as you rightly said, Chair, that some of the parents that you're speaking about are the parents that you're speaking about, that they too are also children. So that shows you the level at which society is. And before us as a legislature, we need to build, part of our responsibility is to build a caring society. So where do we start? The first stop would be the society itself having to realize and recognize that there are these challenges that are before us. And my critique general to a lot of these non-governmental organizations is the issue that I raised is the assisting us to take these processes forward, because we need policy positions on how to integrate this society itself to understand. Coming up with papers that will assist us to take this matter forward and synchronize these things in a manner that society understands what is before us. But what is clearing now is that we will have to, Honorable Chair, then at a point or another, engage with the Department of Health, the Social Services, Education, and come up with a one program that will deal with all these issues. So that when we approach society, we ourselves are also in a well-organized way. Otherwise, we will come here and speak big terms and so on, only to find that the reality on the ground is something else. Because my experience in the rural communities themselves, you find the child who is 13 years old, with a pregnant, going to give birth to the child, and they keep the child at home without even going to the hospitals. That is the experience on the ground that you will find because of the lack of parenting. So this parenting, we must be able to take it ourselves as government and the parents themselves. Where there are no parents, where Honorable Swan is talking about dysfunctionality, maybe we have to provide a design program, particularly social development, on how to take this matter, because we need to tackle it at the front. These things is what is there on the ground is happening, and we see these things happen. If you go to hospitals today, you will see that those who are giving birth are young ones because of the lack of the education itself. So let's encourage that we take this matter further with society itself and the relevant departments, and without putting emotions, because once you put emotions, you start losing the ball.
I think, madam, you are right. It's difficult to solve this problem. Depends on the cultural background of this people. In the Arctic culture, you would not take anybody to court. You probably have parents discussing the matter and come up with solutions. In a society where individuals are hated, where the society is so loose, like in the cities and so, maybe you need to have some kind of a deterrent. The problem is that what type of a deterrent? As Honorable Swadi has put it, it is correct that you do have cases where children growing up doing what they want to do because the society, more especially the Western society, you must be an individual, you must think independently, you must do what you want to do, not what you have to do, what the society tells you to do. So you do have such things. You probably I don't know how we can strike a compromise and perhaps say the parents must be directly involved. So I don't have a solution at the moment. I'm just listening. Thank you very much.
The Honorable Bonga is making an important point that this is a societal matter. We need to involve society. And I'm just wondering whether we should not have a summit which will actually actually bring the faith-based organization, Honorable Swartz. We bring the queen mothers from traditional society who are looking after the children. And I visited some royal families. The queen mothers are running schools which deal with these matters, but their voice does not appear here. We may be talking about rural children thinking that they have problems, whereas the rural problems are able to deal with this situation. And then we want to reinvent the wheel and come to the point that Honorable Kumura is raising about how things are done in the West and how things are done in other cultures. So dialogue, I think, should take us forward. Honorable Maida.
Thanks very much, Chair. And ma'am, thank you for the presentation. Chair, also concur that this is a societal matter. But what pleases me from the two presentations is that they were able to, because if you check various submissions, they just dwell on the fact that these changes are actually changing the age of consent from 16 to 12. And the two presentations were able to clarify that we are not changing the age of consent. The age of consent remains at 16, but what we are dealing with here is to decriminalize. But I also want to say, as much as it is a societal matter, but at the same time, we have a matter at hand that we must deal with, that in a certain period of time, we should be able to amend this legislation and come up with clear proposals that will take us forward. But I think the presentation is actually assisting that we can do well.
South Africans, as early as the 80s, we established that the best interest of the children must guide us. And I think the two presenters are guided by that. And I also agree, Honorable Maida, that and I think Mrs. Omar said we are not changing the age of question. But if you have this dysfunctional society where kids are doing this experiment, and then you want to send all these kids involved in experiments to prison, you are actually creating a much bigger problem. But let's move on to other, maybe others will persuade us otherwise. But so far, personally, I have not been persuaded otherwise. Honorable Bajaki.
Thank you, Chair. Just to welcome the two presentations. And to say that they're actually becoming more and more helpful in terms of how to address the requirements, the judgment that we have. What's important, like the person saying, at the end of the day, what needs to be looked at is what is in the interest of the child. And of course, being guided by our own legislation, and in this case, we find that there is a flaw in our legislation. How do we then do the amendment? Because at the end of the day, we need to actually have a system that ensures that there's proper child protection, development, and survival. And of course, we have various pieces of legislation that are really trying to actually help us to manage to achieve these goals. And what came out of your discussion, which is important, is also to look at how to coordinate all of the efforts. Because we have the Child Justice Act and the other and how are these efforts in a way that does not really end up giving us what is the opposite of what we want to get. And talking about age of consent, I think if I'm listening to Honorable Schwartz, the thing is actually concerned about the gap, which is something that I would actually want with the 16 years old, the 12 and 16. If, for example, a child has got consensual sex with somebody who is 2 years old, what is your take on it? Because for now, it's just with this age that we're talking about, there's just possibility that you might find that sometimes it may be a 12-year-old that is faced with a 16-year-old. And when you look at vulnerability in terms of age, would you really think that's a situation that we can actually manage to deal with? And of course, you've mentioned issues of guidance and education, which is the responsibility of parents. But at the same time, I think whatever we do as a society, we need to actually have a balance. So it don't only just depend on the children need to be educated about what is right and wrong. If that is not working and we have to use law, how are we actually going to manage to come up with legal frameworks and policies that actually make it possible for our children to continue to be properly protected?
Response.
I think I agree with many of the members of parliament who say they want to reimagine society, because I also want to reimagine the South African society free of violence in relation to children and free of all these concerns that really undermine children's best interests and go against their well-being. So I also want to reimagine society, but I think that when we start talking about children as predators, then we need to reflect on whether that isn't a societal indictment. How do we really shift our mindsets when we want to blame children and adolescents for the problems that we have in society? They are inheriting a society that we have created as adults, and they are having to navigate that society. So I think that I want to encourage us just to move towards those principles of the best interest of the child, 0 to 18. They are only navigating a world that we have created for them. So I think I want to go back to particularly the age, because I think that that's the critical issue for everybody, maybe. So as it stands now, the consensual the clauses relate to 12 to 15 years old. So that's just 3 years anyway. My 2 years is in relation to also 15 and 17 year olds, because you know you have 15 year olds that's now below the age of consent, and 16 year olds you have to test the age of consent. So I want a protection for 15 year olds, 16 year olds and 17 year olds, because they are in the same peer group. They are 10, 11, and 12. We must think about these things practically. They are grade 10, 11, and 12. They are the same peer group. And so for us to put barriers in terms of their interaction and relationship building with each other, I think is unwise. We need to make peace with the fact that, you know, children, adolescents, we need to be able to mentor and guide them to have good relationships with each other, so that they mature into adult good relationships with each other, free of violence, free of coercion, free of abuse, especially in relation to sex. Thank you. Okay.
I'm sure you'd agree there are children predators. There are gangsters, 16-year-old gangsters, 17-year-old gangsters. And whilst we've got to face that harsh reality, there are sexual predators, and that is what I'm saying. You might not like the word, but I've been a prosecutor. I know, in courts, what happens as well. Yes, it's very, it's not desirable, and in an imagined world, we would not like that. But some children commit the most horrendous offenses. It is due to society to a certain extent, but it's also due to their own choices. It's due to their own choices as well. That's the one point. Secondly, I didn't understand your difference in the two-year closing age. Why you would prefer it for 15, 16, 17, but not for 12 to 15 and 500. Remember, it's not even 15, it's 15 plus just below the age of 16. So you've got almost 4 years. Age group, and I don't understand the consistency, unless you argue from a constitutional perspective, that would then result in us not complying with the constitutional court order, which is probably the reason why there isn't a two-year age in 12 to 16. Okay.
There's a during tea break you engage. If you reach a deadlock, I'll give you to to deal with this matter. But thank you very much for your very lively engagement with Honorable. But Honorable Omar, do you want to say something? No, thank you very much. Can we move on to Justice Alliance of South Africa? But you must address the chair, not address them, because we don't want to.
Would you like to come there or
that? I think it's come here so that before you start, Honorable Sir, you know where priests, pastors, bishops, archbishops have 7 days a week to make a contribution. So I think we need to begin to speak to them in particular, to use that time to address the dysfunctionality in our society. And the government launched the Moral Regeneration Program, and I think we must encourage them to participate so that we can address it.
Yes, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, my name is John Smythe. I'm here representing the Justice Alliance of South Africa, and I'm assisted, although I'm now separated from Mrs. Ashley Eden, who is a lecturer at university and a voluntary member of our team. My name is John Smythe. We were amicus. Who are the members? Many individuals, churches, corporations, trusts, it's an alliance of supporters. And our constitution provides that we should promote the Judeo-Christian ethic and values in Parliament, in the courts, and in any other, and in the media, and in any other appropriate way. Well, I wasn't planning to. I was planning to get you. You're not right. I'm sorry. It's we've been going for some 8 years, and we have been an applicant to the Constitutional Court in a number of different matters. So we have a reasonably high profile. I think I'm entitled to say that. May I start by thanking you, Chairman, for. Honourable Chairman, for setting aside no less than 4 days for public hearings. I think that's unusual, although I don't know, but it does seem to be something we ought to thank you and your committee especially for. And maybe, again, I don't know because I haven't seen all the submissions you have, but we've been told at the last count, when I was told it was at least 700, I guess it's gone up since then. But maybe that 4 days that you've set aside reflects the disquiet that a number of citizens, I would suggest a high proportion of citizens, have about the straitjacket in which the Constitutional Court have placed Parliament in considering this matter. Certainly in the sphere in which we operate, churches, faith-based organizations, Christian, Protestant and Catholic, Islamic and Jewish, and other NPOs, there is a great deal of disquiet about this Constitutional Court decision. Having said that, of course, I, as a senior counsel from Britain, now retired and as a judge from Britain, fully understand, and I want to make this clear, that there is that straitjacket. I think that's the right way to describe it. You're not given a lot of discretion. It's a question of what you can add to what the Constitutional Court has said, rather than what you can take away, and I accept that, of course. There is, I think, an issue here of sovereignty and separation of powers. I must say that I regret that the Constitutional Court seemed to lose sight of the fact the down-to-earth grassroots issues of the fact that
every parent knows, I'm a parent of four and a grandparent of nine, every parent, I suggest, knows that children need boundaries and children want boundaries. And that seems to be totally lost sight of, as indeed was the fact that there, as has already been alluded to, there are so many families in South Africa which are one-parent families or children without parents at all. And so it may be living up in the clouds to think just of the ideal home where the parents and teachers will do the educating. Education can go so far, but it can't help those who've got nobody to educate them. Nobody at home. One parent out at work. Whatever it is. But on the issue of the sovereignty of Parliament, and obviously this is not an issue for you today, I would just like to say this, that I think the pity of this case was, and I was there for throughout the full hearing, was that Parliament not only found that it breached the dignity and privacy of a child to have these offences on the statute book, but Parliament then went on also, as was right and proper as things stand at the moment, to consider that to do the limitation exercise under Section 36. And I would like to take this opportunity to mention in the hallowed precincts of Parliament that it would be so much better, we submit, in a case like this, if Parliament were to, if a constitutional court were to make the decision about a breach of a constitutional provision, but then the limitation exercise of what is reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society should be passed on to Parliament. Because you, I would respectfully submit, are in a much better position to do that limitation exercise than the Constitutional Court. Maybe, I'm not sure, but maybe it would need legislation to change that. But that's a matter for another day, and obviously I'm not going to dwell on that now. But I do want to begin really by saying that we do, with respect, need to keep our feet on the ground. We're not living in utopia. For a moment or two, when I was listening to the last two speakers speaking so eloquently about their plans and the work they do, and of course I support that and respect it enormously, but we're not living in utopia. We're legislating as much for the poorest family as for the most affluent family who has access to all these services that we were hearing about. So the gist of our submissions, as you will have seen from our written submission, is we believe that we need to add something to the bill as drafted, which I may say, with the greatest respect to the draftsman, I think is a very good bill, bearing in mind the straitjacket that they will put in. I think they've done extremely well. But I do want to suggest that we should add, that you should add something which provides, some people shy away from this word, it's been used by the Honourable Swart, the word deterrence, so that children who want boundaries know where they are. And so the teachers in the schools can say, look, you can't do that, you'll get me into trouble. Or you'll get, like a parent will say, you'll get me into trouble. We can't say now you'll get into trouble anymore, because you won't. But you might be reported to the Department of Social Development or something. You might be troubled to that extent. We'll come to that in a moment. I just want to make two more preliminary comments. The matter of morality has been touched on. That, I would respectfully submit, is a matter which Parliament should take into account. In the same-sex case, the Faria and Bontis case in 2005, Justice Sachs, speaking for the Constitutional Court, said very clearly that the secular and the sacred must coexist in South African society. And we, of course, urge that upon the Constitutional Court, but it only goes so far. And I would submit that a body which is concerned primarily with democracy, as you are on your committee, Mr. Chairman, should certainly take into account issues of morality. Indeed, I would suggest it's incumbent upon you to do so. There's much common ground with what has been said. I couldn't agree more with what's been said about kissing and that sort of thing. I don't understand how Parliament, in all its wisdom, included that in the bill in 2007. One other point which is not in our written submission is overseas. We put before the Constitutional Court what the position was in New Zealand, the UK, and the United States, and now I've got information came to me yesterday about Spain. Practically every other Western country has limits, criminal limitations, which we can't have, on consensual sex between children under 16. So, in the light of the Constitutional Court decision, we are already far and away the most libertarian Western world, if I may use that expression, country. May I go to my submission and deal with it without reading it to you, deal with it briefly. It's only two pages. There's the background matters which I refer to. I refer there to the predator. Again, reference has already been made to the child, the younger child, the 12-year-old girl who needs protection from an older, much older boy. Something needs to be done to provide protection. Somebody said to me yesterday, apropos the program Judge for Yourself, which I appeared on, it was aired on Sunday with Judge Davis. Somebody said to me, well, what about the disabled child? How do we protect the disabled child? Something must be done. And the disabled child, may not know that she can say no. She may not be aware of the fact that she certainly won't understand informed consent. So I'd ask you to consider that sort of situation. Secondly, traditional African law. I know little about it, having come from Britain 30 years ago, but I believe that the protection of virginity is regarded as a high priority in Africa still, even in the 21st century. Thirdly, this question of a public opinion. Well, you will be able to assess that from the submissions you've received, and I'm not privy to what they are, but I do know that when this matter was being heard in the courts, JASA were involved as amicus at both the High Court stage and then at the Constitutional Court stage. I appeared on a number of different TV programs and radio shows, and I think I put the figure too low when I say 80%. It was nearer 90%. Over 80% of those who phoned in, who sent in text messages, opposed the decriminalisation of child sex. Well, I say it again, we can't go back on that, but it makes it more incumbent than ever on this committee, I would respectfully submit, to include something in the bill which will provide a deterrent. And I have put in with our submission, and I hope the committee members have it, just one piece of evidence. We put in a great deal of evidence which the Constitutional Court appeared to ignore. One says appeared because they didn't mention it in their judgment. We refuted certain aspects of the report. We put in evidence from a gynecologist and a psychologist and others, and particularly, which I believe should have been particularly powerful, the affidavit which you have from David DeCorta, principal of Camps Bay High School, who rallied round him the other principals with whom he's in touch, and he says in his affidavit that they had, when they sent out the letter to all the other school principals, primary and high school principals, they had no dissent at all. He was saying in his affidavit, look, if you remove these sanctions, it will make our job a nightmare. That's the word he uses. Many of them wrote in and signed the petition. I think you've got about 40 signatures there. And again, the Constitutional Court made no reference to that at all. I go to paragraph 6. Yes, I think I've dealt already with the question of the sovereignty of Parliament. So I come finally then to our proposed amendments. Difficult as all this is in view of the straitjacket, first of all, I would ask this committee to consider the lower age of consent. The 12-year-old limit below which no child can consent, why not raise that? So we suggested 13 years for both boys and girls. That would reflect, of course, the primary school, secondary school division. I believe it would cut out an enormous number of the thousands of primary school girls who get pregnant every year, and the abortions which almost inevitably follow. So even that incremental increase from 12 to 13 would make a big difference, and maybe you will feel, having discussed the matter and listened to all the submissions, that it ought to be more, and more to be 14 or 15 or even 16. But certainly I would suggest that you should give the most careful consideration to that lower age limit. Secondly, we don't like kissing at all. I've said that already. We believe that should be removed entirely from the definition of sexual violation, and I don't think that's clear in the bill as drafted. It may be my misreading, but I think that should be checked, that sexual violation should no longer include kissing. Now we come to something perhaps more controversial. The Constitutional Court has said, and there has been discussion already. I didn't start till quarter two, Mr. Chairman. I honestly didn't start until quarter two. I need another 5 minutes. Could I not have that? Otherwise, we might feel there's an inequality in giving the two ladies more time. Sorry. 3 minutes, thank you. Why not consider the legislation which we already have relating to a parent who prevents a child from attending school without any good reason, that is in the South African Schools Act? Why not impose a criminal sanction on a parent who knowingly, perhaps knowingly and persistently permits a child, I'm suggesting under 14 years of age, to have penetrative sexual intercourse? I stress again that that's what JASA is concerned with, the danger of penetrative sexual intercourse. And finally, if that is not acceptable, let's adopt something along the lines of the Children's Act, something along these lines, based on Section 54 of the Act. A person who has, now this could come in 54 into your Act today, a person who has knowledge of a child under 14 years having penetrative sexual intercourse may, or should it be must, they're both in the Children's Act in different sections, report the matter to a designated child protection organization or to the Provincial Department of Social Development, who shall thereafter follow the procedures set out in Section 110 of the Children's Act. No doubt your draftsman could tidy that up. So that, I would suggest, would be a deterrent. Teachers, parents can say, look, if you do this, then I'm going to have to report it to, not to the police, we're not bringing the police knocking at the door again, but to the Department of Social Development or to somebody else in prison. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope I got within the 3 minutes.
No, I think that you are proposing to judge me at this time. But let me just say that I don't think it is difficult. The first year of court came to me to come to because we are going unlike in Britain. We don't have the doctrine of the British Parliament. Our Parliament is subject to this agreement by the constitutional courts. So they are perfectly in the right to but also it's presentable spiritual or religion. And we are a secular state. But our secular state does not ignore the fact that the things that are sacred. And that's why we appreciate the presentation by yourself. That's what led you to take the students, because we are not accepting the things that are taken. And that's why we have a that's why we invite faith-based organizations to see the South African Bishop Conference we're presenting. We give full hearing to our religious organization, regardless of the fact that we are a secular state. We will move on to the next presenter, by members of the House. I'll start with the Honorable Mutako, Honorable Horn, Honorable Bonga, and Honorable Smith.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Mr. Smith, for the presentation. And I would like to make a comment and a clarification question. Thank you so much for referring to traditional African law whereby the intention is to uphold morals and values. The intention is to uphold morals and values. And then again, you did make mention to SASA, South African Schools Act, where a parent is refusing to take a child to school, they are punitive measures. And in this regard, you are referring to a similar principle. Now, I would like to know, because you seem to differ with the previous presenters when coming to the age of 12. Do you think that will really make a difference, the 13-year-old?
I think if no child under the age of 13 were deemed to give consent, it would mean, of course, that any sex with a child under 13 would be statutory rape. I think it would be a huge deterrent, particularly for primary school children. I mean, that's what, you know, that is really what one shrinks from so much, the statistics of primary school girls getting pregnant. I would like it to be higher than 13, as I've said, but I think it would make a very significant difference if you put it up just by 1 year. And also in respect of the homosexual aspect of this, because we know that homosexuals are very keen to draw children in at a very young age.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions to Mr. Smythe. The first is in respect of the lowering of the age, or actually the hiring of the age from 12 to 13. The way I understand the bill and also the initial act and the Constitutional Court judgment is that it dealt with adolescents. And the age group between 12 and when you turn 16 are internationally seen as to be adolescents. And apart from the point of view, and maybe justifiably so, of principals and parents, of whom I am one, is there any scientific evidence to indicate that we can change that age bracket dealing with adolescents to say that apart from the fact that most children who are turning 13 will still be in primary school, that there's any other scientific indication that the natural development of children nowadays are not the same as when the the age group 12 to 16 was determined to be adolescents. That's the first question. Then the second question is in respect of the proposal that the parents who knowingly permit children under the age of 14 to engage in penetrative sex should be guilty of an offence. Mr. Smythe, to use his words, referred to the position Parliament is in as this, some sort of a straitjacket in terms of the Constitutional Court judgment. We've also, in our preliminary discussions, talked about not much room to maneuver with. Will it be fair or even lawful if we accept that children under the age of 14 can involve themselves in consensual sex to then, if there's knowledge from the parents of this act, which is not a criminal offence, to subject these parents to being guilty of a criminal offence? To my mind, that would also be unconstitutional if we go back to the fact that the Constitution gives individual rights also to parents, not only to children. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I deal with the last point, first of all? Of course, not when a child plays truant and doesn't go to school, he's not committing a criminal offence. So I don't think that it would be right to say that the fact that the Constitutional Court has said you can't criminalise children means you can't criminalise parents. Indeed, we've thought about these proposals very carefully from a constitutional law point of view, and JASA really specialises in constitutional matters. That is my speciality. And I don't think either of any of these proposals would contravene the judgment or would stand much chance of challenge in the Constitutional Court. And I move then to include the 12 to 13 age change. You ask about scientific evidence there. I would only say that clearly the girls reach puberty at age 12 or younger, or we wouldn't have all these pregnancies with 12-year-old girls. But boys tend to be older, and we've brought, of course, Parliament brought the age down a long, long way for boys in the homosexual range in all this. I doubt if there's scientific evidence, but I would see common sense. We all know as parents what 12 and 13-year-old kids are like. Most 13-year-olds aren't in a position to give consent and make sensible choices. I've done, thank you.
I'm not sure that we can actually ask Parliament to make laws against absurdity. Because for me, it would be absurd to expect that any parent could go and allow children, you know, say, to give you license to have sex. And therefore, on that assumption, say, let's make a law to stop parents from doing that. I think it would be actually going far. But allow me to move on to Honorable Bonga.
Thanks, Chair. The first note I wanted to raise with the presenter was that in this that you have already raised, that the Constitutional Court was within its power to can use the net in the manner in which it is dealt with. Because the people who are analyzing our Constitution and our personal dispensation, they always misrepresent what it is and misrepresent all the organs of the state, the role of the legislature, the role of the executive, and the role of the judiciary. And my conceptualization of the three spheres of government is that their existence in our dispensation is purely in the main about the checks and balances. So you will not take the legislature and put it there alone and think that it has exclusive rights of dealing with certain things. Now, in my view, the presenter started by, you see, which I also requested earlier, that when we deal with this matter, we must try to use an objective test in the main rather than a subjective test. So when he started by saying he has 9 grandchildren and so on, as though the presentation was mainly focused on protecting those that are very close to you. So an objective test may be very important to use just to look at this matter without looking at our friends as parents and grandparents. I think I agree with Honorable Horn on the issue of adolescence. I would not say worldwide, but in South Africa it has been conceptualized as in between the age of 12 and the age of 16. Now, earlier on, the matter was raised that there are other legislation. I want to know from him that did he do some research in terms of other legislation when we are considering the issue of the age of 13, because in terms of taking contraceptives, the age there is starts at 12. So you will take it that 12 is just a well acknowledged number that may have to deal with this matter. And the another issue which I want to ask is the issue that is in page number 3. At page number 3, it wants to criminalize any parent who knowingly permits. My view, I think the way it is drafted, I have a sense that the presenter is not generally understanding what we're dealing with here. Because this says the parent or a guardian who knowingly permits a child under the age of 14 years of age to engage in a penetrative sexual intercourse shall be guilty of an offense. So before us is not issues that relate to this, but it's a matter of saying when there are two adolescents, they engage in that activity. We are just want to take one thing that is no longer a crime. We're decriminalizing only that aspect. And requesting in the main that the role of parents must be in the main, there is a role of guiding and educating together with other related staff. And another issue that I wanted to know from him was the issue around the correctional service. Because one other pattern that we have is the correctional service centers. They are too full, and if we are now going to take these parents to court, if you check in terms of research, what burden are we imposing to the state in terms of this proposed amendment that you're making? Yeah, I think for now, Chair, we can end.
We are not expecting an answer on the second. We have already clarified it, that we are dealing with the issue of two adolescents, not parents. Can you respond to Honorable Booth?
I don't want to withdraw my submission that the committee should consider very carefully the question of whether parents should be held liable in some circumstances. It may be that there will be a prosecution once in the moon, but the point is it would provide a deterrent, and it would provide a parent a chance to say, if you go on doing that, you're going to get me into big trouble. We need some sort of deterrent. Now, on your other point, Honorable Bonga, I thought we were all agreed that we don't want to encourage sex under 16. I think that was the common ground when the two ladies were speaking from the Teddy Bear Clinic and RATCAM. Well, if that's the case, may I rhetorically ask, why is Parliament not in a position to put in other clauses which will provide a deterrent, or perhaps to amend the Children's Act? You know, there are various ways of doing this. But my concern is to put into the minds of the honourable members that there are possibilities. There are ways in which we could help to discourage sex under 16 without criminalizing.
Yeah.
cannot deal with that situation by arresting those children and prosecuting them and sending them to jail.
Mr. Chairman, of course, with great respect, that's our starting point. We can't do that. Your bill is very clear on that, and the Constitutional Court is very clear on that. The question is, what else can we do to discourage sex between children of the same sex? But there's no question. I mean, JASA is the last organization in the world which would ever want to prosecute a child, even less send him to prison. What we need is a deterrent. And the previous law worked very well, actually, because there was always diversion. But that's another matter. That's gone. That's water under the bridge. So we do agree entirely on that.
We do, and that's why the two ladies that presented made it clear that we're dealing with a societal matter. We need a dialogue. So your question, which is a valid question, should be taken to that dialogue.
Thank
and
you.
I assume the dialogue will come sooner than later. Honorable Sharp?
You're running out of time, but it's just a concern of mine that the court did not consider your evidence. I'm sure it considered it, but did not refer to it in the finding at all. I understand, however, that in the High Court, your evidence was presented and it was dealt with. But I think particularly the affidavits about high schools and implications, and here we might need to also consult with the Education Committee in view of there's nothing to prevent us dealing with what you have stated in the light of the Constitutional Court ruling, but the impact on schools that you make out that case for. So that is something we need to bear in consideration as well. But it is regrettable, because the court continually says this evidence is not robust, and we know the state did not present any other evidence. So that one part is regrettable. Secondly, I like your reference to the involvement under Section 4 of social development, and I think that is where the previous presenters also referred to some intervention, not necessarily as you have formulated it. And maybe, Chair, that is something we need to look at as well, to bring in a mechanism where we find a child that is engaging on a continual basis in being promiscuous without infringing on their rights. But the question is, one of the previous speakers spoke about an assessment as to whether that is a child in need of care in terms of the definitions of the Child Act. Now, you might do some research for us on the Scottish law. In consensual sex issues, they have a referral to a children's inquiry as opposed to a criminal sanction. And that, I understand, works quite well. So we understand, and that would be totally within the parameters of what the court set out as opposed to criminalizing. But one could have a situation where you could have a teacher or a social worker or a caregiver that is concerned and unable to control a young child, that there could be an aspect there of a child in need of care. So that's something we could look at when we have that in Darbo as well. Thank you, sir.
That doesn't care for children is no future. And we are very much alive to that. We take very seriously what you're saying, and we will never ignore your proposals. We will engage. And I think that's why we want also support Honorable Sark to say Department of Basic Education, Department of Social Development, Justice, and correctional things, we should have sessions together, not work in silence, and also open the doors for yourself to make it. So don't feel frustrated and think that this is the end of the matter. It's not. And we value your contribution.
Can we have one other speaker? Thank you. wanted clarity on one of the recommendations, especially on item one, that there must be exception for children married under the South African law. I wanted to check whether this exception meant that we will then be allowing them to have sexual penetration, or what actually are we saying?
Yes, thank you. I have a very useful document here. I was going to offer it actually to the Honourable Bonga, which is produced by the University of Cape Town Children's Institute, Legal Guide to Age Thresholds for Children and Young People. Actually, Mrs. Eden, my colleague, produced this for me. I'd be very happy, because it can be printed from the web, to give it to you. But it does seem that I think it's clear that under certain conditions, a child can marry at 12. Well, obviously, if they're permitted to marry at 12, they must be permitted to have sexual intercourse. May I offer you that document? Thank you.
My name is short. I just wanted to respond to Honourable Smart's request that Parliament should actually take into consideration issues of morality. To say outside that it will be difficult for us within the democratic dispensation and all liberties enshrined in the Constitution for us to actually entertain morality. Because what is moral to you is not moral to the next person. And the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa wouldn't be in the position to manage to address that. And it actually also borders on issues of culture. We have different cultures, we've got different religions. And as long as your religion does not actually violate the Constitution, and your culture does not violate the Constitution, it does not really become a problem. So if we discuss from that perspective and understanding, I'm sure it will actually help us to deal with what may actually be put on the table by other presenters that actually borders on the same issues. And that's why I think that maybe the clarity is actually important at this particular point in time. And you suggested raising age to 18 years. But remember, we're actually dealing with a judgment that has actually recommended 12 years. I don't know under the circumstances as to whether you should take into consideration that judgment and how you actually see us really navigating into 18 years.
Deal with that. My reading of the judgment, and certainly I was present throughout the hearing and have read all the papers in the case, I don't think this question of the age, whether the age should be 12 or 13 or any other age, came up at all. It wasn't even dealt with in an overt dictum fashion in the Constitutional Court. So I think I submit that it would be entirely open to Parliament to change that. I'm so sorry, I forget what your first point was.
About morality and
just in one sentence, my submission would be on behalf of JASA that if there is an overwhelming consensus on an issue of morality in the country, then as the leader of South Africa's democracy, it's right that Parliament should pay heed to it. And certainly in this case, there is, I think, an overwhelming consensus about morality, children having sex at a very young age. Thank you.
As to go into a debate about morality, and also even to suggest that we are not concerned with morality, maybe we need a neutral term that is unifying. Namely that we need a value-based society, and the different cultures and religions have contributed to a body of values, and some of these values are already universally and nationally approved.
So I think let's leave it at the level of values, because if we raise morality, we'll start another debate that will take us other way from our business as parliament. But as I said earlier, we have a moral regeneration movement which is open to all South Africans. I think if we want to debate moral issues, let's use that that platform. Can we move on to the next presentation? Honorable Swartha, you wanted to come on morality.
We entered the
back the other day. Yes. Okay. The matter is not closed, but it's not for today.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, and greetings to yourself and members of this committee and ladies and gentlemen present. My name is Janine Hicks. I'm a commissioner with the Commission for Gender Equality. I'm accompanied by our parliamentary officer, Advocate Comrade Jani Rudra, and we thank this committee for this opportunity to make our submission. Chairperson, I think we must state unequivocally that the Commission for Gender Equality supports this amendment bill. We believe that the decriminalization of consensual sexual acts between adolescents is the right approach to take, and we support the spirit of this amendment bill in this regard. We do understand, sir, that the purpose of the principal act was to protect children from sexual abuse, and we share concern with other groups that inadvertently the impact of criminalizing of this natural sexual amongst consenting adolescents has had a devastating impact on young people and has resulted in contradictions in law impacting on the rights of children. We do, Chair, understand the challenge before this committee in balancing and protecting the rights in the best interests of the child, but we do believe, sir, that this amendment bill does address this and effectively does balance and protect the rights. We do bring a few slight suggestions on proposed amendments to tighten the wording. But we do believe that criminalizing consensual sexual behavior among adolescents is not an appropriate approach. We do not believe this is a matter for legislation. We believe this requires an education, a health, and a social development policy intervention. So we believe that this matter, and it requires intervention of parents and communities, as previous speakers have indicated. So in that regard, Chairperson, we do not believe that such required policy interventions are the remit of this bill, nor the remit of the criminal justice sector, for that matter. So on that basis, Chair, if I may hand over to Advocate Anirudra just to put forward a few specific recommendations in support of our support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think the focus of most of the discussion centers around Clause 2 and Clause 3, as well as clauses 7 and 8. Very, very quickly, I support what my colleague has said, the Commissioner for the Commission. The problem that we have is that when you look at the moral conditions of society, and the legal conditions of society, I found this discussion quite interesting. The test was set out in 1975, where you look at the moral convictions of society and the legal convictions of society when you are drafting any legislation. And that test was set out for the highest cost of the land at that stage, and it hasn't changed. In other words, the legislature must look at the moral convictions and protect it and embrace it in legislation when that moral conviction has escalated and has become a legal conviction. So, if you want to take that into the context that we have today in terms of adolescent sex, the legal convictions are that, or it seems that we don't criminalize adolescent sex. That's where our legal convictions stand. So, in terms of SA Personal Lawyers Association versus the SIU, which was a constitutional court case, the legislature is bound in the public interest to legislate in such an issue or in such a situation. And the legislature has the authority to go beyond what the constitutional court has set out. So, this portfolio committee has wide powers in determining legislation as set out in the constitutional court case that I just referred to. Now, the problem with legislating, or the problem with clause 2, is that it's not going to pass constitutional muster to the full extent, because we find that you've got a decriminalization, a complete decriminalization between the ages of 12 and just under 16. And then you find between the ages of 16 and 17 there must be a minimum of a 2-year age gap. And an honorable member pointed out that you must have an objective test. And that is true in our law, we must have certainty. Otherwise laws don't pass the test of legality. And the way it's constructed, there is no objectivity. There's actually ambiguity. So the CGE feels that being a social issue, adolescent sex or consensual adolescent sex, we should leave it to the social institutions of our country, which are well developed, to deal with these issues. Because as much as the protective nature of the amendment will pass the minimum threshold test, it will fail the further test of constitutionality. In other words, it will fail the test of unfair discrimination because you're discriminating between two age groups who are still children. And how this problem could arise is that if you have a girl of 13 years of age engaging with consensual sex with a boy of 16, that still will constitute a contravention of Section 15 and it's a criminal act. Reverse that, the girl of 16 who has consensual sex with a boy of 13 will be convicted in terms of Section 15 of the Sexual Offences Act. So that's the problem that we have. And that's where the matter is going to go again to the Constitutional Court. And that problem is apparent in Clause 2 and Clause 3 of the proposed amendment. Now when we go to Clause 4 of the amendment bill, the CGE supports the proposed amendment where a person who has a conviction or some person will repeat that the person has been convicted and his name appears on the register, and a person who has been convicted and his name is not on the register, that is an innovative amendment. We support it fully and we're not going to discuss it any further. The proposed amendment in Clause 7, the CGE has a problem with this here. We don't support it because the Principal Act is unconstitutional to the extent where the best interest of the child cannot be considered if his or her name is automatically included in the sexual offences register. The proposed amendment, which allows for the child to address the court as to why his or her name should not be included in the register is not supported. Now, our objection would fall away if our recommendation that adolescent sex or child consensual sex in general should be decriminalized because you have constitutional problems with further amendments in the bill. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Yeah, thanks. I'm not sure now that they are really supporting the amendment from what they are saying. But I think a simple matter would be a request that you're seeing the event, you have a problem, or you must just give us an alternative thing that you want us to say, as opposed to just saying. Just say, put something forward and say, this is, if it must read this way, than to say, oppose this without giving those alternatives. Because what we expect, they want to pass legislation, so want contribution, so that we don't want just blank statements. I think that would be my comment.
I think all presenters, you will pick up that members of parliament value very much what you say, and that's why they want you to concretize things. You are a great resource for this parliament, so let's heed that advice of Honorable Bonga.
Thank you, Chair. We've made a submission, and what we propose there is the blanket decriminalization of adolescent consensual sex. That's our recommendation. It's a social issue, and it should be left to social institutions to deal with such issues. For example, the family, child welfare, social support, child guidance and counseling. I mean, those are the appropriate institutions that deal with child consensual sex or adolescent consensual sex, because there are reasons why this happens. It could be maladjustment. It could be role modeling. It could be various reasons as to why this happens. And also, when you are dealing with consensual adolescent sex, you've got to look at the developmental ages of the children as well. Right. Okay. So that's what we say overall. Right. Thank you, Jay. Then, I've answered the question. Then, in respect of Clause 7, what we're saying is that... Oh, okay.
No, I think the Honourable Gentleman is very good in running away from giving us the most important thing to do. You say decriminalize. There are two questions. One, how do you protect? This is what we did. Secondly, decriminalize. And so what? You say you social workers is doing what? Are you going to say the we're going to make the law, as my learned friend has said. What do you want? You want us to say the parents must take care, social workers must take care. How do you want us to do it? I mean, can you concretize what you're talking about? Thank you.
That if you want to amplify some of the things that you said, be free to do that and send that to us. I am just afraid that we can do injustice to other presentations. I can see Honorable Dunlan agrees, you also agree, so that we don't respond now, but be free to amplify that and send that to us. I'm directed here that I'm very cruel to you you deserve the comfort break and the tea break of not more than 10 minutes. There are other venues, but they are available on time as request, and unfortunately we cannot get them now. Can we be back in less than 10 minutes?
Yeah. And we're probably going to cut all the questions in this short scenario.
Not for me.
Wow. I love it when people say about special things like that.
And then just the awkward silence.
Yeah.